Hi guys, welcome to Interested, the podcast for interested people. Quick warnings, there might be some swearing, bit gory, but...
Are you bringing a gory thing today?
Slightly.
What about you, Dan? Is there any warnings to...
I don't think give? So. There's
oh.
no...
Oh yeah, we should
By
probably...
By the way!
This is Dan.
Hello!
Hello!
He's joining us today, so if we've got nothing else to say...
Okay, so... I'm going to talk about King Alfred the Great of Wessex.
Ooh.
He's a very, very important boy. So he was born in 847, or around 847 to 849 AD, around the modern location of where Oxfordshire is. And he was born to be the youngest of five sons to King Ethelwulf of Wessex.
Oh, what a
and
name!
His first wolf, I know. So actually, the part Ethel was part of all of these fancy boys' names, because that actually means like noble
yeah.
or of noble birth.
Oh, yeah.
So like, for instance, like the heir of the king would be called the Ethling.
The Ethling, yeah.
So he was the fifth son. So the first was called Ethelstan. He was then King of Kent and died around the 850s. He doesn't really play much of a part because he dies kind of just after Alfred's born. But his other brothers are called Ethelbald, Ethelbert and Ethelred.
So I shouldn't, like, I know it's like,
it sounds
silly.
Silly.
They are very
Ethel
silly names.
Ethel is spelled A-E-T-H-E-L. E-L, yeah.
My face is just like...
I know. I just wanted to let
like, It's not
know.
Like Ethel, like E-T-H.
It's because it's Anglo-Saxon, isn't it?
Anglo-Saxon spelling can piss off.
Yeah. Can you remind me, like, what were the other big kingdoms in England at that time?
So
you had the Wessex.
There was a lot of other kingdoms. Mercia was kind of like central England, so kind of around like the Midlands area, and more. They tended to have quite a few wars with kind of the kingdoms around Wales. So there would be like the Kingdom of Gwynedd, or
yeah,
that's the only one I can think of at the top of my head because I didn't make notes.
The
on
others
any
have
of these.
Too
the
many
others.
Consonants.
Yeah.
yeah. Welsh.
So they're all counted as petty kingdoms because they're not really that big to be honest.
So it's Game of Thrones basically.
Kind of. Yeah. So the important thing about this is being the youngest of five sons. He has a very slim chance of actually becoming king.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. I was like, wow, did he kill them all?
All of his brothers, other than the first, all were kings of Wessex as well. So, and they all had relatively small lives general.
Oh, yeah. Just from circumstance or from stabby-stab assassinate times?
Not assassinations, but...
Okay.
I'll get onto
that. Okay.
The difference about Alfred as well was...
Was he the king whose stomach exploded?
No, that's
William the Conqueror.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry,
he died. He died, and then they tried to deal with him.
With the grape?
And then his gut just popped.
Yeah.
It was very bad. So, the difference with Alfred was, compared to all of his other brothers, he was very interested in learning and knowledge. He wasn't, obviously he was a very skilled tactician and stuff, but he always had an interest in learning. So there's a really good story about how when he was young, he won a book of Saxon poems from his mother as a prize for memorising it. So immediately from when he was young, he had, you know, he was very keen on gaining wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And he grew up to be very open-minded and intelligent, despite only learning to read by 12 or later. So yeah, he was obviously very very open-minded to the other aspects of being a king rather than just waging war.
Nice.
So when he was quite young, his father was deposed by Ethelbald, so that was his father's second son.
Was he bald?
He was not bald.
He
could have been bald.
Yeah, we don't know. They didn't take photos back then.
I'm sure there's actually a meaning behind the bald part.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure what that is.
Might have been there.
Because, actually, I think Alfred, or how would you say it? So, A-E-L-Fred.
Yeah.
Actually meant I think it meant like wise council or elf council.
Ooh.
Along those lines. Which is quite incredible considering he then grew up to be a very wise and...
Wise council.
Wise and counsel.
Like prophetic name.
Yeah.
Gosh.
So yeah, his father was deposed in 856. There was small conflicts, but eventually they agreed that Ethelbald would rule historical Wessex, so kind of the western shires, and his father would rule in the east. But 2 years later, his father died anyway.
Uh-oh.
So Wessex was then brought back as a whole and ruled by Ethelbald.
Healthcare was not great.
I'm not sure how old his father was, but probably around his 40s or maybe 50s. Alfred, I think, died around his 50s as well, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Which is probably pretty good for...
I think they would say that old man about people in their 50s. Like, that was an old person back in the day.
So, Alfred was actually not mentioned during any of the short reigns of his brothers, until Ethelred's ascension to the throne in 865, aged 18.
Oh.
So they were all very young and they had very small reigns. So considering that it's only been about 10 years and already they've gone through the second son and the third son. So that's two kings in the space of 10 years and they're all relatively young.
Oh, so gosh. Life expectancy.
Lots of stuff was happening there.
Getting infections and dropping off.
So by this time, when his brother was 18 and took the throne, Alfred was 16. And so his biographer, Bishop Asser, titled him Secundarius, which meant most likely that he was the recognised successor. So I don't know if they used the word heir back at them, but obviously... him using this word,
secundarius. Yeah, do you think etymologically, do you think that's where we get succeeder?
Possibly, yeah.
Might be from the Anglo-Saxon word.
Also, it should be said that this is all really well known because the works that he did as his biographer were also followed or part of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles. So pretty much every aspect of Alfred's life is documented, which is really incredible, actually.
Yeah.
Considering that we're talking about someone that was alive in the 850s, 800.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
How many years ago was that? Because sometimes I need to just say
1,200 odd, around that, or maybe 1,100 and something.
In the first millennium.
Yeah.
Literally.
Wow.
3 years after his brother took the throne, Alfred and Ethelred fight to keep the great heathen army of Norse warriors out of the kingdom of Mercia. So the great heathen army was very different to what they'd seen previously. So there were raids such as Lindisfarne, which is really famous. But this was a full, actual, pretty much invasion of Britain, with the intention of staying and settling, rather than just raiding and taking back.
So by Norse, is that Germanic or...?
Norse is in like...
Scandinavia.
Yeah. So the Vikings, yeah.
Oh, okay.
The Danes.
Yeah, Danes. The Danes. Danes is probably more...
That's the accurate word, isn't it?
More accurate than Viking. This was like a full actual attempt of taking over and settling. They obviously had some kind of good relations with Mercia, and it goes on to say, actually, one of his daughter ends up being the first lady of Mercia at some point, which is
so
really
interesting. So they marry the kingdoms together. That's
There's connections before as well.
You were mentioning like the heathens, so you can explain that England was Christian at this point.
Yeah, so at this point, obviously, all of the Anglo-Saxons were Christian. The Great Heathen Army were of the full of people that were pagans.
So the Norse mythology has
Norse mythology, Germanic paganism. So as well as being a different culture, different peoples, they brought with them a different religion.
So the heathens.
Yeah.
So there's an aspect of almost it being a holy war as well, in some senses. So at this point, Alfred was 18, and he was fighting with his brother against this great heathen army that invaded. They'd already, so they started kind of at the top of the country, as we know it, so around Northumberland, and they pushed their way down. So think about, at this point, Mercia is in the middle, so they're already halfway through the country.
Yeah.
So they fight in the Kingdom of Mercia with the Mercians against these, and fail. So they push through Mercia eventually. They reach Wessex in 870, and there's 9 main engagements that were fought. Really, I think it was only around 3 were actual victories for the Saxons, so it's really not really going well for them, to be honest.
Oh dear, they're getting devastated.
There are some good victories, such as on the 9th of January 871, the Battle of Ashdown was a Saxon victory and was credited to Alfred, followed by more defeats. But it's the fact that at this point Alfred was being credited for a lot of victories, even being very young.
Yeah. Do you think that, so, because Asa, or Asa, was the wordsmith for Alfred, do you think it's, like, not that reliable? Because...
Well, that's the thing.
Is it propaganda? Is it saying, like, Alfred was great?
I feel like it's definitely going to be propaganda, but what else info do you have?
Exactly. It is the only thing we can go off, really.
Yeah.
And it likely is much in Alfred's favour. But he was never known as the great until the 16th century by other writers that gave him that title from, you know, Asa's works and stuff, and
which
seeing how
great
he is.
Yeah.
But we can only, obviously there's no other kind of thing that we can base off.
Yeah,
so this is the only thing.
There's no way to fact check.
So,
it's quite interesting.
But there is evidence for his greatness, or genius rather, later on that I talk about.
Yeah.
So after these defeats, Ethelred, his brother, who's ruling at the time, likely died as a result of sustaining injuries in these battles, probably on the 23rd of April. So a few months after this.
How can they get battle, like, a direct date for that? 23rd of April? How do they know that? From, like,
well,
carbon
it's
dating?
It's all documented.
Oh, bloody Asa.
Yeah.
Got the date down.
All documented.
Whoa.
Which is
useful. So cool, though.
Yeah.
Oh.
So he then took the throne in 871. So think about the fact that his father was ruling in 850s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So literally less than 20 years on.
Yeah.
A succession of all of his brothers basically had ruled, and now he's king.
Wow.
Which is pretty incredible.
That's why you're going to have an heir and many spares in this day.
So as soon as Alfred
took
the throne...
Just pump them all out. That's the woman's role.
As soon as he took the throne, he was left with a lot of problems, obviously. So there were more defeats of the Danes, and this led Alfred to have a kind of forced peace, which was honoured, and they left, likely at a huge cash cost. So likely cost him lots,
like,
to kind of pay them off.
Piss off.
It wasn't a victory as such, this peace. Even though obviously he needed this peace.
Yeah.
He likely paid for it very substantially, so to say.
And then also they might just come back later after they want more gold.
Oh no! Foreshadowing!
But also importantly, so this, in this piece, they kind of divide the rest of England as what they call Danelaw, which is kind of, you can see why, so it's ruled by the Danes.
Yeah.
And I think they set up like almost like a puppet king in Mercia. So the Kingdom of Mercia still exists, but it's kind of ruled by someone that's allied, really, with the Danes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this peace happens, but then in 876, there was a new leader, a Dane leader, called Guthrum, who attacked and occupied Wareham in Dorset. So we're talking about like kind of very central Kingdom of Wessex, really deep in their kind of heartlands. As soon as there was a siege and blockade around them after Guthrum took this place, he just managed to slip away. He just...
Alfred?
No, Guthrum.
Guthrum.
So they surrounded him in Wareham after he attacked it and occupied it. And he managed to just slip away with all of his troops.
Wow.
And then...
How do you do that?
And then...
do you think that's not written? I'm just thinking of Ace's like priorities.
Just being like,
do you think he was just like, oh yeah, and he just disappeared, and it was actually like a devastating, like embarrassing thing on like.
Oh, I'm sure it was incredibly devastating.
I mean, that's still embarrassing that he just got away.
You have to remember though, with a siege, obviously without all the technology we have now, in the night it probably wouldn't be too hard to slip away.
I guess they can just walk.
But an entire army.
I don't know how, like, because they
I suppose it's geographically as well, like,
yeah.
The people who are, what do you call the people who are sieging us?
Well, the besiegers.
The besiegers.
Besiegers, and then the besieged.
The besiegers, yeah. So it depends on if the besiegers are awake
first. Yeah.
Yeah.
And are, like, surrounded, you know.
But anyway, so after this, he runs off to Exeter, and then after that, he withdraws to Mercia, which was obviously ruled by a sympathiser, in a way.
Okay. So Guthrum is trying to take over.
Guthrum is just causing havoc,
right,
really.
Just causing shit.
However, after this, he then makes a surprise attack on Chippenham, where Alfred was staying at. So this is, really, he only just escaped with some of his men and fled to the Somerset Marshes. So
Alfred.
Yeah, so easily he could have just died then.
Yeah,
like it was only lucky very. Escape. It was incredibly lucky that he managed to get out of that.
Two lucky escapes.
So you can see immediately his reign is going terribly.
Oh no!
It's just not his.
But he's still great.
Ace is
just like
he is still great. He is. It is in his name. He's just great.
He's just great.
Yeah.
That's what the Tudors told us.
And there's actually a really cool story about him when he escapes into the marshes. Is he? There's a story that he finds like a hut with an elderly old woman in there. He doesn't know that he's the king.
Yeah.
So
yeah, photographs.
Yeah. Maybe so she just one thing leads to another, and she allows him to hide there, and she. Just tells him to look after, like, you know, all the pans and what's cooking while she goes out and gets some stuff. So, but the story goes that because he's so preoccupied with all this devastation stuff happening,
oh no, he
burns it, and then he gets slapped round the face by this old woman, which is pretty funny.
Yeah.
The King of Wessex just gets slapped up.
I love that.
By an old woman. Obviously,
that's so
really,
funny.
Is it real or not? We don't know. But
it's a great story.
It's still a great story. however, so following this, he raised men from Somerset, Wiltshire and Hampshire to what was called Egbert's Stone. So just an area for them to regroup and for him to try and salvage this situation. So I should say, this is essentially three fjords, as they were called, or levies, which consisted of a lot of men. So a lot of probably untrained and not well-equipped men, but a huge number of men. So like basically everyone who was part of the kingdom had a responsibility to be called up as part of the fjord. So any kind of landowner or peasant or anyone, really.
Mm.
And there was actually a fine on people who didn't answer the call, and they would be fined a set amount of money.
Yeah.
So, three fjords, huge amount of men, basically. And this led to the Battle of Edgington around the 6th or the 12th of May, 878.
I love that there's like exactly.
Oh my gosh, incredible. My birthday is then.
Oh! Happy birthday.
Happy War Day.
Shit.
People died on your birthday.
So Alfred knew that if he were to try and attack Chippenham, it would go disastrously because, you know, he's learnt the hard way that these Danes are very good at taking fortifications and making them stronger. So, you know, he, in previous battles, I think it's even written somewhere that he knew about how dangerous they were in these, and that even though he may have the numerical superiority, mm-hmm. it would likely go terribly. And keep in mind, obviously, because these men are all a lot more trained, probably, than
the peasants who've just been dragged out.
The Fjords probably were raised, you know, maybe not as much, but still enough that if they start fighting, they gain more experience as they fight. But being just freshly raised, maybe not as incredible.
From the villages.
Yeah. So
here's a pitchfork.
What he did instead was he lured the Danes into fighting in the field, which was much, much more even than if he were attacking Chippenham.
A besieger.
Yeah. And so a quote from The Medieval Life of King Alfred, by another guy called Alfred, actually, based on Asser's work. This quote says, "Fighting ferociously, forming a dense shield wall against the whole army of the pagans, and striving long and bravely, at last he gained the victory. He overthrew the pagans with great slaughter, and smiting the fugitives, he pursued them as far as the fortress." So he lured them from the fortress, fought them incredibly,
pushed them all the way to the...
brought them back to the fortress.
Whoa. They'd be running scared.
Obviously, there's an unknown amount of casualties on both sides.
Do they know, like, what kind of armour and the way they fought? Is there much room?
Well, at this point, it would be fought with shield walls. So that would obviously include linking shields together to literally form a wall of shields. Pretty much all of the people fighting would be using spears, which obviously they'd be able to
stab
through
the
gaps in the shields.
If it's Christian, that means the Romans have been and gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that'll be kind of post-Roman armour.
This is post-Roman armour, yeah. So if you're talking about the actual Fjordmen, probably not great armour.
Yeah,
but
the
pagans, the Danes, probably would be using some kind of mail, mail armour, so like kind of interlocking, like iron rings or whatever material they were using. Likely probably was the same kind of thing for the Anglo-Saxons, but if we're talking about the peasants, talking about the peasants, probably just some kind of leather armour or something that wasn't as incredible.
Yeah.
But at this point, even if you were wearing better armour, if you get injured, it's probably not great anyway, so...
Yeah, you just hope you're the one at the back.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to get involved, so you can just sneak away. I'm just going.
There wasn't really cavalry as such at this point. It was all pretty much mostly just infantry fighting. And yeah, pretty much just shield walls, really, I think, off the top of my head. So yeah, obviously unknown number of casualties, but it was clearly a great victory for Alfred.
Great success.
Great success.
Great Alfred success.
Also the fact that he had 3 Shire levies, which means he likely did have the number advantage.
Yeah.
So he could probably afford to lose a good few men if he wanted to. But knowing what we do about him, it's probably unlikely that he would just throw lives away.
Right.
Just because he can.
He was a clever boy.
Essentially, after this, he just starved them into submission. So he didn't try any other further assault on Chippenham or attacking them. He just waited until they ran out of food. And then he made them surrender under certain terms. So these terms were Guthrum himself and his main lieutenants were all baptised. He took on the name Æthelstan. And he was to leave Wessex for East Anglia, Which him and his army did by 879 and settled there. So he just made Guthrum a Christian.
Wow. That was only payback for like taking his kingdom.
Well, also just to leave Wessex and never come back.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that is quite good.
And they all then settled in East Anglia.
Well, I was fascinated by how much communication there was in England to Italy and the church in Rome.
I was just going to say, reminded me, Alfred, when he was young, actually went to Rome himself.
Oh, really?
And his father.
Wow. Yeah, there was like lots of travel. Obviously, you know, not for the like farmers.
Obviously, but
he actually, like... I think he possibly was baptized by the Pope.
Really?
Himself.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, he is the future king, so I suppose.
But they didn't know he was going to be future king, would he? He was,
yeah, he was
literally
the fifth one.
The fifth in line.
Wow.
Well, it would be furthermore if any of his brothers had sons.
Yeah.
And actually, Ethelred, the one just before him, did have sons, but he was too young to actually rule, so they agreed that Alfred rule. And I don't think there was any bitterness really about that.
Yeah, what was primogeniture like in this time? Do you know what primogeniture means? It means like the male, eldest male is the heir.
Eldest male is the heir. If there isn't any male to inherit, it then goes to
the nearest male relative.
That was
in this time. It would be
that was the case in Mercia, but then
was it
Alfred's daughter then kind of basically ruled as queen.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know. Wow.
She wasn't
know
called
about
a queen. She was called the First Lady of Mercia.
Yeah.
But essentially, it was
queen means in Anglo-Saxon wife of the king.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean equal ruler.
No.
Queen is an Anglo-Saxon word.
So anyway,
sorry.
All of this was under what was called the Treaty of Wedmore, which was followed by a more formal treaty being called the Treaty of Alfred and Guthrum in 886.
Ethelstan? Is that his name now?
He is now called Ethelstan,
and he's now a Christian.
He is now a Christian boy.
And he can't come back. Go away, Guthrum.
Which he does actually, I think he fully commits to his baptism now though. So he doesn't like secretly believe in paganism or whatever. He just fully commits to it.
Oh, really?
Which is pretty cool.
Oh.
So anyway, under these terms, Mercia is split between Wessex and East Anglia. And he basically sets better boundaries to limit conflict. Guthrum was the first Anglo-Dane ruler to actually mint coins under the what was called Alfresian model. Which in itself shows an integration into his new role as a Christian and as a settled Dane. So it sounds like, from what we know, he kept relatively good relations with Alfred. I don't think there was any more wars. So he ruled in East Anglia, I should say, as well.
Oh, okay.
He ruled in East Anglia. But like I said, he was an Anglo-Dane Christian ruler. He was obviously in these terms with Alfred. After all of this happened, it kind of seems quite chill, you know. There's no big wars happening. There are some serious attacks that happen. However, Alfred is more prepared for this. You know, he hasn't just been thrown into it at the deep end and having to deal with it.
Not getting slapped by an old woman.
No, he probably didn't get slapped by an old woman anymore, which is good news for Alfred. Alfred was more prepared for this, and none of these attacks were ever as successful as what happened before. So one of the reasons Alfred is thought to be such a genius at this was his creation of a solid system of defence and command over his domain.
Mm-hmm.
So what he did in terms of trying to defend against future attacks was he first increased some of the economic burdens on the people. So obviously increased taxations and stuff to fund some of the things he was going to do. So he, you know, increased tenant and landowner obligations of military service, fortress work and bridge repair. However, he then obviously also expanded the tax and conscription based on individual productivity, which I thought was pretty cool. So he doesn't do it in terms of everyone pays one certain amount. He changes how much people give depending on how productive their land is, which seems very progressive, really, doesn't
it? Yeah,
it
does, yeah.
So rather than a set increase for all, it's very how much they provided or could provide. And this was called a hidage.
A hidage?
Mm-hmm. Now, this was to support the burgle system, as in B-U-R-G-H-A-L, as in a burg.
What's a burg?
Well, these were fortified locations.
Mm-hmm. A burg.
This started in 880.
They didn't eat burgers. Okay.
He couldn't resist.
I couldn't, yeah.
So these were fortified locations, and there was 33 in total around his kingdom. They were located across the kingdom to combat attacks that happened anywhere in his land. So if any attack happened anywhere, he could respond to it. This could include smaller outposts, locations such as, you know, just had extra walls or palisades, so slightly more defendable. Or it could just go to the whole fortification of entire towns. So
like as a refuge point for a village, maybe. Or
but
like
also, most importantly,
protected.
Where there's fortified locations, so that depending, it doesn't matter where an enemy were to attack, they can't make significant gains. And it gives enough time for Alfred to then mobilise enough troops to combat them and defeat them. So it even included, you know, former Roman towns with rebuilt walls. Because at this point, even though the Romans had left many hundreds of years before, a set place to defend.
Like foundations.
An example of this is Winchester. So, you could just go to the Winchester and wait for all of this to blow over.
Oh my god, is that literally what you were waiting to do this whole time?
I didn't say that. I didn't put this down just to be able to say that, but I'm happy about saying it.
So how many of these places were there? The burg.
There was Burgles? 33 burgs.
Burgs.
Like B-U-R-G-H.
Yeah, okay.
33 in total.
Across Wessex.
Across all of the Kingdom of Wessex, mm-hmm. Yeah. They were arranged and linked by roads, which meant that if there was Viking attacks, they were much... The Viking attacks themselves were much harder for the Vikings to actually have any kind of success and limited their communication.
How come?
Because it meant that with all of these places being linked by roads, the response time of the Saxons was much quicker.
Right.
And it meant that they were able to kind of outmaneuver the Danes that were attacking.
Yeah.
It was also designed so that all of these places were within a set distance of each other.
Okay.
So it was literally like a net of fortifications across Wessex.
Yeah.
So it literally would mean that they could respond to any kind of threat at any time.
Is it like the bit in Lord of the Rings when someone sets a fire going and then...
God, your calls for aid! I guess so. I mean, I don't know if they had massive fires on mountains.
That's probably a bit extra.
Well, they'd have messengers, wouldn't they? But
they'd
be on horses and not...
Gallop, gallop, gallop.
Yeah, not lighting fires on mountains.
I feel like that's not very secret, is it? I feel like you're just telling the Danes, we know that you're here and about to attack.
What, lighting fires?
Yeah, just lighting massive fires.
Well, I feel like at that point, it didn't really matter if they know or not.
Yeah, okay.
Because if they'd already start attacking, they'd know sooner or later that someone news would get out about them.
Yeah.
But anyway, he is also revolutionary for other factors.
Ooh.
So, in the late 880s to the early 890s, he issued a new kind of code of his own laws. There was 170 chapters, which is a lot.
That's a lot. That's a lot of writing.
Well, if you think about the entire laws of Wessex, it kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, but a lot, like, physically.
Physically, writing is a lot.
Like, ink wasn't just lying around.
No, that is very true.
Very laborious.
Lots of writing that down. Lots of quills,
Lots
of ink.
Going through a lot of birds, probably.
I think a lot of birds died in creating his laws.
Oh, dear. Not very vegan.
So, in this book, there's laws about compensations and scaled payments for injuries, theft, etc. However, the only crime that could not be compensated by money was treachery to a lord.
Oh.
So basically, any other law that he put down, to some extent, it could be compensated by money.
So it was always pecuniary.
Yeah. However, if it was treachery to a lord, that was not acceptable.
So that was likely
just getting killed. Yeah. And he then also follows the example of what was known as the Carolinian Renaissance at the time in France. So the Carolinians were kind of like a famous royal family in France. And in doing so, he recruits lots of clerical scholars from across England and abroad to improve learning in his court. Because as we learned previously, he was always very interested in improving learning and gaining wisdom.
That's wonderful.
So on top of this, he also founded a court school for the education of his own children and that of the nobility. And actually, many of lesser birth.
Oh, really? Really?
Where they learnt writing, reading, and this is both in Latin and English, and wow. Christian learning.
Wow!
So it's both education in terms of reading and writing, but also a religious learning as well, yeah. It could be.
Studying the Bible.
Yes. Well, this is I get onto that as well, which is very... very cool and interesting, and I never even knew about it.
I'm so excited.
So firstly, he was important because he proposed primary education should be taught in English.
Oh!
Yeah.
That is big.
That is very big. Very revolutionary. Those wanting to go further to a holy order should continue to be educated in Latin.
Yeah.
So it's almost a set thing of education first in English and then if you want to further on to Latin.
Wow.
Now what I find really cool is he sets a program of translating books he deemed most necessary for all men to know into English from Latin.
He did that himself or he demanded
He ordered it also was responsible himself for doing his own translations.
Wow.
Which is really cool.
So what were the books?
There's various religious books and works. So ones that he did himself, he translate for himself.
Yeah.
The first one was Gregory the Great's Pastoral Care.
Oh. Looking after my sheep.
Yeah. Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy.
Wow.
St. Augustine's Soliloquies.
Mm-hmm.
And he did also the first 50 Psalms of the Psalter, that's spelled like how you'd say spell Psalms, but like P-S-A-L-T-E-R.
Ah, but you
Psalter.
Oh, okay. Psalter.
He did all of this himself. He probably got advice from some of his other scholars on some things.
Yeah.
But the important part is he ordered a big translation and he did it some himself, which is very, very interesting. And the significance of this is also the fact that they were still popular throughout the Middle Ages.
Wow.
So hundreds of years. He had a very big influence.
In terms of learning, that's so cool.
In terms of learning, and it was probably such a big influence as well because his entire life was biographed.
Yeah.
Because obviously, a lot of the time it was word of mouth with stories about people, such as like King Arthur. Obviously just folk tales and mythologizing. Legend. Kind of, mythology. Whereas this king himself was fully written down. Everything about his life is able to be
which
seen.
Is so great for us, because we obviously still, thankfully, obtain...
So, as well as this, a thing about him using English as well is there is what's known, you might already know it, as the Alfred jewel.
I don't. Oh, wait, maybe I do. Keep talking and then I'll tell you.
So it's a goldsmithing work which was presented in the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. It's thought to be like kind of like a part of a stick kind of type thing that would top that, which you would use when you're reading, almost like as a thing to see.
Like to follow the lines.
Yeah, follow the lines. There was a few of these made, I think. Obviously, only for the very important religious figures, because it was incredibly rich, valuable metals that were used in it.
Yeah.
However, and the inscription on this reads, Aelfred Mechet Cir Vercan, which reads, Alfred ordered me to be made.
Yes, I do remember this. It's incredible. I do, yes.
And I think that it's obviously not a significant thing in itself, but it's incredible because it kind of gives some insight into Alfred using English rather than Latin.
Yeah, so that's in English. That's not.
That is in Old English. That's written in Old English. Can I see it? So yeah, Aelfred.
Aelfred
Mechet Kievercan. So we can see that all of these things he did, obviously. There is
not
some extent,
so Game of Thrones.
There is some extent that whether it's true or not, everything, because it is biographed by a close source to him.
Who,
And he did himself order Asa to do this. So it likely is quite
favouring
him.
So his bad deeds aren't going to be
If there are any bad deeds, weren't written down. But obviously, you know, it isn't biased to the point where it says about how they were, you know, he didn't say that they were successful at everything, because he does point out that there were big defeats at the hands of the kings. So there is some kind of truth there.
There might just be things that are unsaid.
Yeah, there is likely a lot of things that are unsaid. You know, life for the lowest people in his realm is probably still quite dire, despite all of these amazing things he did. And whether it actually impacted them as much, it's hard to tell.
Yeah, you don't know how well a common person would have been impacted.
You don't.
They probably wouldn't have received the education that he...
However, what we do know is that pretty much all of the translations he did were all still incredibly popular in the Middle Ages. And he tried his best, it seems, to provide for better well-being physically and spiritually for his people.
That's cool.
A lot of these places, you know, Wessex, Essex, Middlesex, is literally West Seax, East Seax, and Middle Seax.
Oh, so it's Wessex, but just split up, like the current counties in England. That's so cool.
So it's that you can see like the terminology with how it actually comes from, you know, because they're like, they would be called like the West Saxons, for instance, the East Saxons, the Middle Saxons. And then,
obviously that just merges over time in language, and then you've got, I love language history. I'm just like, give me all the etymology. I love it. That's so cool.
So technically, he couldn't be called King of the English because he didn't actually unify all of England.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I was like,
He was called, he was titled king. The King of the Anglo-Saxons, which he was in a way, because essentially he had complete control over all of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, really.
He was still.
Through connections. So, for instance, his daughter being married to the King of Mercia, and then when he died, she became the First Lady of Mercia.
Love to know about her. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Anglo-Saxons are.
I don't know how much information there is actually about her.
Oh yeah, fucking woman.
As a woman. So yeah, Alfred had a very long-lasting impact, and it still has a lasting impact. There's still things being named after him.
Really?
There's statues of him being built. So yeah, that was all about King Alfred the Great. So that's my bit done.
That was amazing. Thank you, Don.
As promised, I'm bringing an artist today.
Oh!
And oh my god, I've been researching this artist for like 2 weeks, and I still sat down and was like, oh my gosh, where do I start? She's so cool.
Oh.
Also, happy late International Women's Day.
Happy International Women's Day.
And happy day, Dan.
Oh, it's a happy day.
Yeah.
Happy for
it's
women.
Just a happy day.
So, I'm talking about Frida Kahlo.
My queen, I love her so much. Oh, she there is a lot on her.
There is so there much. Is oh my god.
My bi queen, my disabled queen. Like, sorry, don't ruin it.
Spoilers.
Sorry, I'm sorry.
You've ruined it.
Yeah, we're gonna start again now. God. All right. So, Dan, have you ever heard of Frida Kahlo?
I've heard of her, but I don't know anything about her.
You probably know her.
But I see
eyebrows.
There's a very nice cat there.
Yeah. So yeah, for all the people who don't know Frida Kahlo, she was a Mexican painter. And she's mainly known for her self-portraits, and they're quite distinctive because in them she always paints herself with a thick monobrow and a moustache.
Yeah.
Not like a kind of like twisty moustache, just like a faint moustache.
Yeah.
Because
girls have dark hair sometimes on their upper
lip.
So it's basically like puby boy level moustache.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Puby boy level.
The classic.
That's so rude to read about day.
I mean, but she would accentuate it in her pictures because it was kind of to make her stand out and also to emphasize her kind of masculine side. She was born on the 6th of July in 1907, and she spent most of her early life in the Blue House in Coyoacan, which is in Mexico. And I mean, it's just referred to as the Blue House. I'm guessing it's just very blue. They're talking about like blue on the outside, inside. Yeah. Oh my god,
it's very blue.
Yeah,
I've seen photos. I'll put it on the Instagram.
Yeah. When she was 6, she got polio, and although she recovered, she was left. Her right leg was left much shorter and much thinner than her left leg, and she was quite self-conscious about this.
Well, you would be, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Anyway, her dad had epilepsy. And because
it gets worse.
Yeah.
The unluckiness gets worse.
And because like both her dad and Frida shared this sort of experience with illness, she became his favourite daughter. And he actually encouraged her to do loads of sports like wrestling and loads of other stuff to help her leg recover, which obviously was very rare for a woman for a young lady.
Yeah. When was she around again?
That was in 1907.
Yeah.
So, early 20th century.
Yeah. Women be not
doing
sport.
And also, Mexico was very, like, macho at this time, so really rare.
Hyper-macho.
Her dad also taught her how to use a camera and how to, like, touch up photos, because he was a photographer.
How did you do that back in the day?
Like,
how did you touch
you had, so it was very detailed and precise work, which kind of leads into the precise nature of her painting.
Oh, okay.
He also lent her her books from his library to kind of, because he talked about like Frida was the most like me, she was the smartest.
That's funny.
Yeah. And when Frida was 15, he involved her in the Preparatoria, which was a really prestigious school in Mexico. It's kind of like the Eton of Mexico, but for slightly older kids. And she was one of the first of 35 girls ever admitted.
Wow.
And she was like so clever. So she said that she could just read a page and instantly remember everything.
Oh my
so
god.
So she didn't That's try crazy. Particularly hard at school, but she except she was
She's
like
good at
yeah.
school.
So she really wanted
people.
To be a doctor. Yeah.
yeah. just...
So yeah, she studied medicine, botany, and social sciences, and she really wanted to be a doctor.
Botany?
Yeah.
Oh.
Shout out to Dan.
Dan's our horticulture boy.
I like leaves.
I like leaves and trees.
And it was at the preparatoria that she became really interested in Mexican culture and also became active politically, especially in communist ideas.
Ooh.
So she was very naughty. Oh my gosh. So she joined a gang called the Cachuchas, which means like the caps, because this group would wear peaked caps as like a rebellion against the strict dress code.
Oh my word. So they were basically the Peaky Blinders of Mexico.
No, they were like slightly different. They weren't like what we think of peaked caps.
Okay.
They were different.
I was just thinking because they're named after the caps with the bloody knives in them.
Yeah.
What was their gang called again?
The Cachuchas.
Cachuchas.
Yes. And so this gang, oh my gosh, they were really naughty. So one of the...
A gang at school, not like, because I'm imagining like a drug gang.
No, okay. A gang at school.
Okay, yeah.
But they weren't just like a normal school gang. So one of the less sort of nasty pranks they did was like riding a donkey through the halls. So and like
iconic.
But they would also do things like set fire to. So the preparatoria hired artists to paint murals. And they set fire to the sawdust underneath the scaffolding.
Oh, no.
To the point
Why?
Where the artists would started wearing pistols to, like, ward them off.
Holy shit.
Oh, like, while they were painting the mural, they would, like, light fires underneath them. That's so bad.
It was,
That's just not naughty. That was, like, a felon. Yeah, that's, like, arson.
Literally.
That is arson.
They would, like, put soap on steps so that people would slip when they walked down them.
That's quite funny, but also
it
dangerous.
Is. Yeah.
Can you imagine the safety nowadays? But just
they were little shit. Oh my god! Like,
so did she get expelled or did
no?
They,
she
happened?
Did get expelled, but then her dad was like friends with the head teacher,
so did a little nudge.
Yeah.
Back in.
And then he was basically, and then the guy who was in charge of the school, like not the headmaster. I think he was above the headmaster. Was like, listen,
governor.
If you can't deal with this little, like, kid who's got, like, who's...
Pranking.
Yeah.
Probably too intelligent to be in a classroom.
Yeah, and if you can't deal with this little girl, like, get a new job. So...
Oh,
and, definitely more than just a school gang.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
So one of the artists who was painting these murals was called Diego Rivera.
Mm-hmm.
And he was... really famous, and because Diego would be accompanied by various beautiful models on his scaffold.
Oh, right.
And
right.
Because, as models for literally models.
I was like, why? Like, were they just chilling out? Like...
And the first, so two in particular, the first was his fiance Lupe Marin, and the second was a famous beauty, Nahue Olin.
Mm-hmm.
Apologies for that pronunciation. As I said, I think I said before, so not only was she in this gang, the Cachuchas,
mm-hmm.
she was also going out with the leader of the gang, Alex. So, yeah, so, and he described her as sexually precocious.
Oh!
So, yeah.
She was a very liberated woman.
She was. And,
how old was she at this point?
So she was 15 when she enrolled in the school. She was about 16 when she started
right.
going out with Alex. Then in 1925, she and Alex were on a bus and they were involved in a horrific accident.
Ooh.
So I've actually got a quote from the book that I read. Actually, I should probably just mention the book. So the book I read was called Frida, the Biography of Frida Kahlo. And it's by Hayden Herrera, and it's amazing. It's like 600 pages, so it's a long read, but...
You read all of it?
Yeah.
What?
Well, I know, that's why I was literally like, I haven't listened to anything else, I've just been working. But it's so worth it, it's so good. I've got Alex's account of of what happened. Quote, I remained under the train, not Frieda, but among the iron rods of the train, the handrail broke and went through Frieda from one side to the other at the level of the pelvis.
Oh.
When I was able to stand up, I got out from under the train. I had no lesions, only bruises. Naturally, the first thing I did was to look for Frieda. Something strange had happened. Frieda was totally nude. The collision had unfastened her clothes. Someone in the bus, probably a house painter, had been carrying a packet of powdered gold. This package broke and the gold fell all over the bleeding body of Frieda. When people saw her, they cried, La ballerina, la ballerina. With the gold on her red, bloody body, they thought she was a dancer. And then, talking about the handrail, a man said, let's take it out. When he pulled it out, Frieda screamed so loud that when the ambulance from the Red Cross arrived, her screaming was louder. Her spinal column was broken in three places in the lumbar region. Her collarbone was broken and her third and fourth ribs. Her right leg had 11 fractures and her right foot was dislocated and crushed. Her left shoulder was out of joint, her pelvis broken in three places. The steel handrail had literally skewered her body at the level of the abdomen. Entering in the left side, it had come out through the vagina. I lost my virginity, she said.
I've got like...
Oh my god.
I feel really like tense and...
Yeah, how do you think my vagina feels after hearing that? Oh my god.
Wow, Alex really came out of that happily, didn't he?
Yeah.
Compared to her.
Oh my god.
It was horrific. And
oh my god.
She had to have like 32 medical procedures. She struggled with it, with her health, for the rest of her life. And remember, in Mexico, healthcare wasn't free.
Yeah, how does she afford that?
Well, she doesn't. So her family... So her dad had been, like, the national photographer for Mexico. So they had some money, but, you know, they were... So some of the medical procedures weren't performed because they just didn't have the money. But,
yeah,
you know, her dad... Oh, she was her dad's favourite, so he tried, but, you know... It's pretty difficult. Wow.
I knew that she was like bedridden for very long periods of time, but I didn't know like the extent of that crash.
It was
how horrific that is.
So horrific.
Oh my god.
Yeah, so she was in bed for more than a year.
Yeah.
And her hopes of becoming a doctor obviously squashed. To make things worse, her relationship with Alex was put under strain because his parents sent him to Europe to try and cool off the relationship.
What?
Just sent him to Europe?
Just sent him away from them?
Yeah, for education. Oh, I mean, it was like, you know, the grand tour.
Yeah,
that was a normal thing. But, yeah. But also, Alex had found out that... So, before he went to Europe, Alex had found out that Frieda had an affair. So it may have also been partly him just being like, oh, I need to, you know, get away from this. But by the time we went to Europe, I think they had made up. Mm. But yeah. So alone and bored out of her mind because she's just stuck in bed, that's when she began to paint.
Mm-hmm.
So her parents got her a special easel, which she could, like, paint from bed without having to sit up. Mm-hmm. And they also attached a mirror above her bed so that she could see her reflection. And so she basically painted the only thing she could see, which was herself. I've got a quote from her, which is, quote, I paint myself because I'm so often alone, because I'm the subject I know best, end quote, which I just think is so heartbreaking.
That's really sad.
And, you know, there are all these letters to Alex that she writes, sort of, and they're just so painfully lonely.
Mm.
Like, she is, like, very, sort of, not clingy, but sort of effusive with her love and sort of demanding of his attention. But I just think she's so lonely, like, she was just desperate.
Being like left behind in terms of development and like, obviously him literally going off and touring about, like she could have done that with him, obviously.
Yeah, maybe definitely.
Not because of her gender, but I'm sure her dad, who was so, like...
No, I mean, she planned to go away, like, in the future.
Yeah,
but
completely robbed of... And then also, like, just being stuck in your secondary school childhood friends. So, obviously, he's progressing in terms of like, meeting people in Europe. And then her only connection, who isn't her family, is has gone away.
Well, I mean, she did get visit. She did have visits from the other Cachuchas members.
That's nice.
Yeah, like she was visited, but really he was the person. He was the only person that she wanted to see.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you know it was sort of very, you know, passionate.
Yeah,
young
your
love.
First teenage loves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then
photos
this is
of her in the bed with the easel.
Yeah.
Which I will be posting. On the Instagram.
There are loads of amazing photos.
Mm-hmm.
So we're gonna skip forward in her life a bit, just because there's so much to cover. And so this is the forward to the point where she meets Diego Rivera again.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, Diego.
I recognize that name.
Yeah. Diego is 41.
Yeah.
Frida is 21.
Yes.
Oh no.
Yes.
And they meet at the party of Tina Modotti, who was one of Diego's mistresses. And shortly after this party, Frida goes up and demands that he sort of look at her paintings and tell her honestly whether they're any good. And like she's like, look, I know that you, as soon as a girl talks to you, you just say, oh, they're great,
they're
because
pretty.
You want to get in her pants. She was like, I'm not interested in that. Tell me if they're any good. I have medical bills to pay off. I need to know if this is worth my time.
Oh, my queen.
I know, she's so cool. And then Diego was immediately impressed, and he said, the canvases revealed an unusual energy of expression, precise delineation of character, and true severity. They showed none of the tricks in the name of originality that usually mark the work of ambitious beginners. They had a fundamental plastic honesty and an artistic personality of their own. And, you know, that says all. And Diego was basically like, you have to keep painting no matter how hard it is.
They're very striking as well.
They are. They're really powerful. So I'm going to, as I said before, I'm going to split this her life into two parts. This episode I'm going to do like her life.
Yeah.
Next episode I'm going to talk about
art.
Her art, because there's not
it's
enough time to mix it together.
Yeah, definitely.
So for anyone listening who's like, why aren't you talking about her art? It's coming, I promise.
It's just because her life is so interesting as well.
So after he saw her paintings, Diego began courting her. He was still married to Lupe at this point, but they divorced, so it's fine.
Yeah.
And this was to her mother's horror, because not only was Diego like 20 years older than Frida, he was not exactly the most conventionally attractive man.
He's quite fat, wasn't he?
He was. So Frida was 5'3", petite, and absolutely gorgeous. I'll show you a picture of her. So this is Frida Kahlo. She's gorgeous.
She's stunning. She does accentuate the male parts. There's a painting next to her photo.
And yeah, she definitely accentuates the masculine side of her. She almost kind of gives.
It's still her. You can see the likeness, but
yeah, because in the photo you can see she does have a monobrow and a moustache, but her face is very feminine. She's absolutely stunning.
Mm.
Like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And Diego was slightly different. This is her and Diego.
Oh yeah.
So. Diego was huge in every sense of the word. Like, like literally though, he was. There's no getting around it. So he was 6'1", and over 300 pounds.
Over 300 pounds.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Which is, and 300 pounds is 136 kilograms. So it's a lot. That's a lot.
Oh, that's a lot.
Holy shit.
And he had large bulbous eyes that even he admitted made him look slightly like a toad.
Oh,
I mean, before you feel too sorry for him, he had affairs almost constantly, regardless of who he was married to at the time. A doctor once proclaimed him unfit for monogamy.
Yeah.
A diagnosis that he happily accepted.
Oh, wow.
He's like, oh, great.
Yeah, and none of his negative features prevented women from flocking to him.
Yeah.
Strange. I was just thinking that. He obviously had ways in the bed.
Yeah, well, maybe. I think it was a mixture of, A, like, he was really famous. And it's like fame and power. Mm. But also, he had a really unusual temperament. So he actually enjoyed talking to women.
That'll attract women.
He really valued
wanting to talk to us.
so he really valued their minds and opinions.
That's
And this was a rare and very attractive trait in the highly
still
macho.
Still is attractive, everyone.
Yeah, highly macho-centric Mexico. Or anywhere at that time, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah. Everywhere.
Yeah.
It's quite good, then, that she decided to show him her paintings.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's true.
Definitely. Even though she cut through to him anyway.
Yeah, because it's quite surprising that...
might have just gone... Ugh.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's quite surprising even he did, because he was famous.
Yeah.
And there was this little
squitty,
like, 21-year-old going, "Oi, look at my paintings now."
Yeah, yeah. He was obviously captivated by that.
Yeah.
By her character.
So Frida's father gave Diego permission to marry her.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably because of the medical bills.
Yeah.
And Diego actually paid off the mortgage on the blue house once he and Frida were married. So
really?
You know,
yeah.
it was a good bet on Frida's dad's part.
Yeah.
But he also warned Diego, and he said, "Notice that my daughter is a sick person, and all her life she will be sick. She is intelligent but not pretty. Think it over if you want. And if you wish to get married, I give you my permission." Firstly, when he says she's not pretty, I'm like, have you seen your daughter?
Rude.
Like, she's gorgeous.
She's amazing.
But I suppose she's not, like, maybe not conventional.
And also, I suppose, maybe he means, like, her body is wrecked.
Yeah, I suspect that's what he means.
So, you know, in that culture, he can't say, right, you can't, like, have normal sex with her, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
I don't know.
I mean, she seems...
She got around it.
Yeah.
But...
I think...
But I imagine a metal bar going through her vagina.
Yeah. It's going to do some damage.
Will destroy some of
Well, her pelvis was...
Wonky.
Broken in 3 places.
Ugh.
So, yeah.
Did she ever want children? Or
we'll
is that coming...
I'm going to talk about that more next episode.
Okay.
So, yeah. They got married, and despite Diego's faults, he definitely gave Frida more freedom.
The freedom.
Than many husbands. He admires strong and independent women, and he expected Frida to have her own ideas, friends, and activities. And most of all, he encouraged her to paint, which was obviously super important.
Yeah.
I've got a couple quotes which kind of describe the two aspects of their marriage. So the first is, if he did not open car doors for her, he opened worlds, which is lovely. And then the second one was, she treated him like a god, he treated her like a sweet thing.
Ah. Problematic.
Yeah. So after the marriage, Frida and Diego travelled to San Francisco, because Diego had an exhibition at the SF MoMA, which is the Museum of Modern Art. Far from being impressed by the rich and famous Americans, Frida scorned them, and she said, "High society here turns me off, and I feel a bit of rage against all these rich guys here, since I've seen thousands of people in the most terrible misery, without anything to eat and no place to sleep. That is what has most impressed me here. It's terrifying to see the rich having parties day and night, while thousands and thousands of people are dying of hunger." Yes.
Ooh.
Yes. It's a great Gatsby mood.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And then when they moved to Detroit, she was even less impressed. So she was alienated by the social elite's snobbery. They were like, "Oh, who's this Mexican
Probably
woman wearing weird clothes?"
Yeah. Because you can talk about how she's dressed and stuff, obviously.
And she retaliated with her characteristic mischief. So at dinners, she would use expressions like "shit on it" or "shit on you" and pretend
in
English and pretend she didn't know what they meant.
Oh, I love that.
I love that so much. I bet she suffered no falls.
Yeah, and then she would say she would delight in the embarrassment on the faces of who she called the old biddies.
That's so funny.
And when she was invited to tea with Henry Ford's sister, she talked like she just spent the whole time talking about communism and how great it was.
Oh my god.
The best thing, so this is quoted from the book again. Once when Frida and Diego returned after spending an evening at the home of Henry Ford, whom Frieda knew to be an avowed anti-Semite. Diego burst into the apartment, chortling heartily. Pointing to Frieda, he cried, "What a girl! Do you know what she said when there was a quiet moment at the dining room table? She turned to Henry Ford and she said, 'Mr. Ford, are you Jewish?'"
Oh my god.
Which is fantastic.
I bet she had such good fun.
She's such a
queen.
She is. She's just like, well, if you guys are going to be snobs, I'm going to have some fun.
That's so funny.
And I love that Diego was like all for it.
Yeah, totally. I bet they had so much fun.
Yeah. And whilst in Detroit, Frieda fell pregnant. Although at first she was worried, she was like, should I have an abortion? You know, I know that my pelvis is fucked. But the doctor said, no, you'll be fine. You can have the cesarean and you can give birth that way. Unfortunately, because of her pelvis, it just did not work.
The utero, did it not grow?
It just disintegrated. The kind of fetus just disintegrated. She suffered a really awful miscarriage and lost the child in 1932. And she was in hospital for 13 days recovering because it was that, you know, she lost so much blood.
Oh my gosh.
And this was the first of three increasingly traumatic miscarriages. And that was the inspiration for the famous painting Henry Ford Hospital, which I'll be talking about next episode.
So was she never able to give birth?
No, she wasn't. She was desperate to have kids. It was so sad.
Did that damage do some kind of damage to her womb then?
I'm guessing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the description was all
crazy. Yeah, because her pelvis never healed properly and...
Oh, that's so sad.
It is. So after her miscarriage, she was so homesick and just depressed that she and Diego had to move back to Mexico because she was like, I just want to go home.
Yeah, surrounded by Americans.
Yeah, and Diego was really angry and resentful of having to go back to America because in America, you know, he was being celebrated.
Sorry, she's had a traumatic bloody miscarriage.
Yeah.
Shut up, Diego.
Oh, it gets worse.
Oh.
Not necessarily because of this, but probably feeding into this, he started an affair with Frieda's younger sister, Christina, who was her favourite sister. So, although Frieda had accepted all of Diego's previous affairs, like, she was like, yeah, he has affairs. It's just a thing.
She knew it. It was going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you could never imagine it happening with your sister.
Yeah, she was like, this was too much for her to bear. She was like, no. I mean, also, Christina, why?
Also, Christina, yeah, I was going to say, like...
There's
two people in an affair.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
A consistent. And, yeah. And she separated from Diego, cut off all her hair. She gave up her traditional Mexican dress in exchange for menswear. And she looks so good in a suit.
She looks peng, like...
She's so good.
She's really cool.
She is. And she then began her own affair with a photographer called Nick Murray. And that affair would last on and off for about 10 years. And eventually Frieda did forgive Diego and Christina. But by this time, she had definitely matured. Like, her love for Diego never wavered at all. Mm. Like, she was still adoring in every way. But she was a far more, like, complex woman. She wasn't just the young girl infatuated. She was kind of... you can see it in her art. So she becomes much more confident. She's kind of a rounded person. Like, she's just grown up.
Yeah, mature. Yeah.
And her art includes a much more assertive sense of her Mexican identity. So after they got back together, Diego continued his philandering. But so did she, with men and women. And although Diego actually encouraged her affairs with women, she hid her affairs with men because of his fierce jealousy and loaded pistol, which... like to brandish around.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
So the gay thing was fine with Diego. Yeah. It was other
men.
Other dicks. Yeah. Ho ho.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So whenever she had affairs with men, he hated it, but then if he had affairs...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, that was fine.
That was fine.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's just standard, isn't it?
Yeah.
Standard male behaviour.
He was told by the doctor.
Oh, God, yeah.
He's not made for monogamy.
He can't help it.
He's got a sex addiction, like, obviously.
Yeah, the other thing that probably led into the affair was after the miscarriage, doctors told Frieda that she couldn't have sex for a bit. So
she was like, oh, go to the women.
No, that was like before. So that may be why he went to Christina.
Oh, I see.
So, but yeah, it's still the fact that he chose
keep it in his
pants. Her.
Oh yeah, no, there's no justification. Yeah.
Incredible.
There is, yeah. So one of Frieda's more famous love affairs was with a Soviet revolutionary called Trotsky.
Oh.
Yeah. So after I know, it's crazy. After Trotsky was exiled from Russia, he went around a few other countries, but kept getting kicked out because, you know, orcs.
Communist.
Yeah, tricky. And so the Riveras invited him to come live with them, and they stayed in the Blue House. So Trotsky and his wife stayed in the Blue House rent-free for like 2 years.
Oh, wow.
Whoa!
And they had protection from all the people trying to kill them, you know. And it was in this time that Frieda began her affair with him. And
in the Blue House?
Yeah, so Frieda and Diego were...
His wife was there.
Yeah. So they used to...
Frieda!
So Trotsky used to, like, give Frieda books, and inside there'd be hidden notes. Or she would say, goodbye, my love, in English, and Trotsky's wife wouldn't understand.
That's cheeky.
It is. It was super cheeky.
Was it, like... Did they genuinely, like, goodbye my love? Did they genuinely have, like, an emotional thing? Or do you think it was just, like,
well,
silly attraction?
Well, I mean, they definitely acted on their attraction.
Yeah, but was it, like, emotions?
Yeah.
Or was it?
Yeah, I think so.
So was she still having an affair with him when he got ice picked then?
Yeah, I was like, he the one that got
ice picked? So I'll get on to that. So, Frieda was actually the one who ended the affair. There's a quote
not
saying...
Not the ice pick.
No. And there was a quote saying, oh, I was very tired of the old man.
Ooh.
So she was just like, yeah, I just got
so
tired
how old,
of him.
Yeah, how old was he?
He was old. Like, I don't know how old he was.
She's got a thing for old men.
Yeah, well... Yeah, because Diego was quite old, and, but also younger man. I think it was just,
yeah.
And and he wrote her a long letter saying, sort of proclaiming his love for her, saying, please don't do this. And she was like, soz. She did do him a painting, though.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
A painting of him, or?
No, of her.
Nice.
Yeah. To say that he could remember her.
Here's a face of me.
Yeah.
My face. Happy birthday. It's me.
That's so funny.
That's so funny.
I feel like that would do you more damage, really, because if you imagine, like, he's like,
when he
I'll get over her, and he looks at this paper, no!
When he left the Blue House, he left the painting behind.
Oh.
I mean, I wouldn't
yeah,
take
that picture home. Especially
like,
Frieda's wife.
Yeah, also, yeah. Like. Did the wife never know then?
I think she did.
Oh, okay, yeah. Kind of hard to keep that
within
a house.
She 100% knew, I think.
Poor woman.
Yeah, and he left. He was ice-picked after he left, and...
Should we clarify that? Because we know
about
the ice pick.
So, Trotsky was assassinated with an ice pick.
Nice.
Yeah.
I feel like it was in a different country, actually.
Yeah.
No, because Frieda was implicated. Frieda and Diego were both implicated. Because the assassin basically, like, cozied up with Frieda and was like, oh, hey, I want to be your best buddy.
Oh, my God.
And so... There was like letter correspondence, so they were like, "Hang on, why were you talking? Why were you with this
assassin?"
And then
did she know?
No, so she was devastated, and
oh
she felt
God.
Really guilty.
Yeah.
And
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
What a life.
What a life. And anyway.
Also, Trotsky was one of the... I don't think we explained who Trotsky was.
He was a Soviet revolutionary.
Yeah, he was one of the big boys, though.
Yeah.
He was one of the very early boys.
Yeah, he was like with...
He was with the Mensheviks to start with.
Yeah.
Oh,
anyway, I'm gonna move on because there's so much to cover.
Yeah, sorry. But, let's not go to the revolution.
So yeah, Trotsky was like, she's so cool. Even Picasso, who was a famously difficult character, he praised Frida's artistic and personal qualities. And basically, from the moment he met her, he was immediately under her spell.
Wow.
He gave her a pair of earrings that were like shaped like hands. They're really cool. You can see them in some of her self portraits.
Yeah,
painting.
So Picasso made that for her.
I don't know if he made them, but he gave them to her.
That's crazy.
And whilst looking at a drawing that Frida had done, he said to Diego, "Look at those eyes. Neither you nor I are capable of anything like it."
Whoa.
Yeah.
Also, Picasso.
Yeah.
Picasso saying
Picasso.
That.
Yeah, like...
Wow.
And it wasn't just Picasso who was impressed by Frida's art. André Breton, who was the founder of Surrealism, was so impressed by Frida's art that he wrote to his friend and art dealer, Julian Levy, and Levy immediately, like, invited Frida to hold her first solo show in his New York gallery.
Whoa.
So Levy quickly invited Frida to hold her first solo show in his New York gallery. Frida travelled to New York without Diego this time, so it was just her. Her arrival was sensational. People were fascinated. They were like, whoa, look at her clothes. Again, clothes come next episode, but, you know, anyone...
I was going to say, I was like, anyone, I'm not talking about the clothes.
Anyone who likes beautiful dresses and just clothes that look like a work of art... gonna love her fashion. And so yeah, people were just in awe of her, and her exhibition was a huge success.
Mm-hmm.
So she sold loads of paintings, and it was just a really good time for her, and actually a good experience in America, which was pretty rare.
For a Mexican.
So she stayed in New York for a few months before sailing to Paris for a second exhibition. And she did not like Paris. So she was bored by the surrealists, and she just she called them like the craziest load of motherfuckers or something.
She's so funny.
Apart from Duchamp, who she really liked him, she said he was the only one who had his feet on the ground.
Wow.
So yeah, she didn't like it. Was just like this exhibition in Paris wasn't as successful, but the Louvre did actually buy one of her paintings.
Ooh.
So, you know,
yeah,
very pretty cool. Impressive.
So before this point, was it kind of like whenever she went places, it was just kind of like for Diego as such? So this is actually her starting just for herself?
Even at this point, it was she was as the wife of Diego Rivera, the famous painter. So it wasn't
Frida Kahlo.
I mean, well, obviously there were people like André and Picasso who saw her for her,
but
the public, it was, when they visited the exhibition, it was like the famous, you know, there were some really awful things like, oh, the famous artist's wife dabbles in art.
Dabbles.
Yeah, but to be fair, she had the same opinion of herself. Like, she did not see herself as a serious artist.
Mm.
It was very much Diego pushing her to do all this stuff.
That's lovely.
And, you know, but she does get recognition later on, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, but at this point, probably that's not the correct way to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, yeah. And then she went back to Mexico, and Diego requested a divorce in 1939.
Ooh, not a great year.
Although the divorce was pretty short-lived, because in 1940 they remarried.
Oh.
And Diego was basically like, yeah, the divorce was bad for both of us. And even when they were divorced, they saw each other constantly.
Oh.
So...
Why did he do that?
I don't know.
It's a load of hassle to go through, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Just for 1 year of separation.
Also, they probably still really liked each other.
Yeah, 100%. And
he probably just had a little spat and then he was like, I'm losing.
Yeah, but like, although when they got back, although when they remarried, like, Frida was, as always, besotted by Diego.
Yeah.
Diego is my life, Diego is my love, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
She wasn't a fool and she definitely was not a doormat.
No.
So when they remarried, it was on her terms.
Mm.
And she set out the conditions. So the first thing would be Frida would keep her finances separate. So
wow.
She wanted to maintain her independence. And the second thing was that they would no longer be sexually intimate.
Oh.
So she was like, well, I'm fine.
Why did he agree?
Well, because she said that she accepted that he was always going to have affairs, but
yeah.
She wasn't willing to be kind of, to be disrespected anymore.
Yeah.
So it was like, you can have that, but I'm not going to be a part of it.
I'm not going to be hurt by it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Also, because her health was deteriorating, heterosexual intercourse became increasingly difficult for her.
Mm.
So at this point, she started having more affairs with women.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, although that probably played a part, I think most of it was just, hey, I'm not going to let you sort of have sex with me and all these other women. You either have me or you get none of me. Like,
queen.
I know. So yeah, Frida started having more lesbian affairs. Often, and I love this part, often the women she had affairs with were the same women that Diego had previously cheated on her with.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So she'd be like, oh, you're going to have affairs with them? Oh, well, now I'm going to...
So am I.
Yeah, and often her relationship with the women lasted way longer.
Yeah.
Yeah, she also, like, with Lupe, even after Diego divorced her to marry Frida, Lupe and Frida actually were friends.
Oh,
yeah,
and were they friends in other ways?
I don't think with Lupe, but
okay,
she definitely had loads of really cool lovers.
That's
and,
really cool.
Yeah. So, now it's the 1940s,
mm-hmm.
and this is when Frida's work started to grow in fame. So that previously, as I said, she had been, most of her publicity had been as the wife of Diego Rivera, and now she was seen as a painter in her own right, as well as his wife.
In her life.
Yeah,
yes.
In her life, I know.
That's so nice.
It is.
That's so nice.
So yeah, Frida dies in 1954, I think.
Yeah.
And this is 1940s, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
so, so you can really see how people were really starting to take her seriously because there was an exhibition of her work in the Guggenheim. She was appointed to a teaching position the same year. She also received a national prize for her painting Moses, and the two Fridas painting was bought by the Museo de Arte Moderno in 1947. And although she struggled to make a living from her art, it definitely wasn't because of lack of demand, but it was more her refusal to edit her work to make it palatable for the public.
Yeah, yeah.
So she was like, oh, you want me to make this less gory? No. If you don't want blood,
no.
Go somewhere else.
Oh, so her paintings were gory.
Some of them were really gory. In fact, quite a lot.
In what sense?
I've only seen her portraits.
Depictions of herself in extreme pain and lots of blood. And there's one where she's giving birth. So you can literally, she's like, so like her, it's of a woman, which I assume is her, but there's like a sheet covering the top half, and then there's just like a huge head, which is not like a baby's head, it's like a full grown head coming out from between her legs. And then, there was one where it was, so quick trigger warning, just about to talk about something which relates to suicide. So there was a young woman who committed suicide by jumping off a building, and a woman asked Frida to do a painting, thinking it would be like a remembrance portrait.
Oh, no.
And Frida did a painting of the suicide.
Frida, no.
And so
Frida, no.
And Frida knew the woman, like, beforehand as well.
Frida, why?
Because this was how she expressed herself.
Yeah.
And so at the top it was showed the woman just jumping, then it was her falling, and then at the bottom it was her lying all broken.
Whoa.
And bleeding. And obviously when the woman received the portrait, who she was intending to give as a gift to the young girl's mother.
Oh no.
She was like, oh no, I cannot. So yeah.
I can definitely see why a lot of these the public wouldn't want to have. But
shocking nowadays, let alone.
It also shows how, you know, strong she was in her beliefs of what she wanted to do as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And not just changing what she wanted to do because of what other people wanted.
Definitely.
Which is really cool.
So
even not, well, I mean, she could have changed it for her friend.
Well, no, because I think there was a mistranslation. So Frida offered to do a painting, and the woman misunderstood what she meant.
You would have thought she'd think, why is she asking for a painting of her committing suicide?
Well, no, it's a specific art. It's a specific picture style. It's you know, religious paintings of
a triptych.
Kind of. It's a bit like a triptych.
I'm just here, like, what?
Triptych.
Wow.
There's a Mexican word for it, but it's basically like that. So it's a specific painting type, which Frida did quite a lot of. So, but just as her work was finally getting full recognition, her health started like deteriorating really, really quickly.
Mm.
And I've just got a quote from the end, sort of the solo exhibition that she had in Mexico. So, quote, "As it became clear that Frida was close to the end of her life, Lola Alvarez Bravo decided to organise an exhibition of Frida's paintings in her Galleria Arte Contemporaneo. The show was to be Frida Kahlo's first one-person exhibition in her native land. When the night of the opening approached, Frida was in such poor health that the doctors forbade her to move, but she did not want to miss her opening, and somehow her attendance was becoming of its own momentum and event. The phones at the gallery kept ringing. Would Frida be there? Was she too sick to come? Art reporters in Mexico and abroad called to ask about the show. The day before the exhibition opened, Lola Alvarez Bravo learned that Frida had taken a turn for the worse, but still insisted on coming to the inauguration. She would send her bed so that she could attend lying down. A few hours later, the huge four-poster bed arrived, and the gallery staff set about rearranging the paintings so as to include the bed as part of the show. Minutes after the guests poured into the gallery, sirens were heard outside. People rushed to the door and were astonished to see an ambulance accompanied by a motorcycle escort, and Frida Kahlo being carried from it into her exhibition on a hospital stretcher. The photographers and reporters were so surprised, said Lola, that they were almost in shock. They abandoned their cameras on the floor. They were incapable of taking any pictures of the event. After most of her friends had embraced her, the guests stood in a circle around the four-poster and sang long into the night."
Oh my word.
That's crazy.
And then the last thing I'm going to... She didn't die then, but a quote from when she did die. So, from Diego. "July 13th, 1954 was the most tragic day of my life. I lost my beloved Frida forever. Too late now, I realised that the most wonderful part of my life had been my love for Frida." I'm literally crying.
I'm crying. Oh. That's so beautiful.
Well, can we just appreciate what a whole entrance?
I know. Carrying, she was just like there at her exhibition in her bed. And also, her bed was not like a normal bed. It had a skeleton on top. Because it's like a, I don't know, I think it's a Mexican thing where they have the skeleton of Judas.
Oh.
I'm not.
Whoa.
I know.
Frida.
And she had so cool. All the communist memorabilia.
Oh my god.
And
what really just went in hard. The four-poster as well, it said.
I know, yeah. It was a big bed.
A whole four-poster bed. What a move.
I feel like a movement has happened through my body.
So, yeah. I'm going to leave it there because, yeah.
I'm going to leave it there. 54 minutes in.
Yeah, so I hope you guys enjoyed that, and wait till next week when, actually this Friday
we're recording, when
I'm doing the second part, which will be about her clothes, her teaching, politics, and her, of course, her paintings.
Yes!
Very cool.
So that's all from us today. Thank you so much for listening. As always, you can find us on Instagram at interested.podcast, where we post contextual images in accordance to what we have discussed in each episode. You can also contact us at interested.podcasts@gmail.com if you have any questions. Thank you so much to Dan for being our guest on the podcast this week. And as always, remember to stay interested.